Well, good afternoon, Juno. It's Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. It's just about 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Today on the show, we're going to hear from Ken Fix about the planetarium presentation and some details on the upcoming transit of Venus, which is only visible all the way through in Hawaii and Alaska, believe it or not. Jonas Lamb will drop in to tell us how satellites are connected to the library, and the speaker tonight and tomorrow, Albert Bates, will be here to talk about his talks, and the Gastineau Elementary folks will come in to tell us about changes that are being made at that school. That will have Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and a little bit more today on KTOFM. The weather looks like this. Rain is going to develop tonight. Now you knew it was coming anyway, didn't you? All right, and then it's going to rain probably through Thursday. And then Thursday night it's supposed to clear up a little bit. Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, clouds.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canada's top Native leader has officially launched his campaign for re-election as the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. And as Dan Karpinchuk reports, Sean Atleo is making some big promises.
Flanked by his family, First Nations leaders and supporters, Sean Atleo said he is honored to have served all First Nations across Canada. He said the journey continues with the rights and needs of Aboriginal people front and center. Atleo, the incumbent, has a strong support base in British Columbia, where he launched his re-election bid, and he is considered by most to be the front-runner for the elections to be held in mid-July in Toronto. Atleo says under his leadership, First Nations people will be given a voice, especially in the face of big industry and the push to develop resources.
Whether it's pipelines throughout the north, pipelines and development right through here to Vancouver, or major development across the country, usually these projects have planning spans of 25, 50 years. First Nations rights, treaty rights, completely dismissed and very much an afterthought. Well, it needs to be understood that First Nations will have a say over resource development.
This race, however, will be an interesting one. Atleo will be challenged by Terry Nelson, the Manitoba chief considered a long shot, and by Bill Erasmus, who has been a regional chief for the Northwest Territories for nearly 20 years. But the wild card is Pam Palmiter. She's a Mi'kmaq lawyer and Toronto professor who has never been elected, but who has a large grassroots following. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A small tribe in Northern California held a war dance against the federal government this past weekend near the Shasta Dam. The Winnemin Wintu say the U.S. Forest Service has refused to grant them private access to the tribe's ancestral land. FSRN's Christina Onnestad reports.
Shonas, the war dance is an act of preparation for a coming struggle, according to Gary Hayward Slaughter Molokahi. He's a war dancer with the Winnemem Wintu tribe.
In a war dance, you're asking the spirits for strength, power, in order to withstand the enemies that are being set against you.
The Winnemem Wintu are at odds with the U.S. Forest Service. Next month, the tribe will hold its coming-of-age ceremony for their next chief and spiritual leader. The ceremony is on ancestral land at what is now the Shasta Trinity National Forest. They want private access to 400 yards of the McLeod River, but the Forest Service has not granted their request. Jessie Sisk, mother of their future leader, says the tribe is increasing the pressure by blockading the river during their war dance.
This is like a practice to close the river off. So if the authorities do not close the river off when her ceremony comes around, then we're just going to close the river off with or without their approval. Because I can't put my daughter in jeopardy of drinking boaters.
Since 2006, the tribe has documented disruptions by campers and boaters on the river, and last month brought it to the attention of the Forest Service. The Forest Service says they're taking the request seriously. Christina Onnestad, National Native News.
Federal officials are addressing Indian education. White House and U.S. Department of Education officials are gathering input. They're seeking suggestions and concerns on urban Indian education. The meeting is taking place today in Seattle, Washington, with tribal leaders, educators, and the general public. Members are named to an advisory council for Native American farming and ranching. The council will review issues related to Native American participation in U.S. Department of Agriculture farm programs and advise the Agriculture Secretary. The council of more than a dozen people include farmers, ranchers, and federal officials. Members of the council were announced last week. During this week in 2009, public hearings were held in Torreon and Albuquerque in New Mexico to address race relations and concerns of Navajo citizens. The Navajo Nation Human Rights Council met with community members and city leaders. Navajo people talked about education and health care concerns. The commission continues to hold similar meetings in communities across the Four Corners region and has signed agreements with different cities to address and improve race relations. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Just coming up on 6 minutes after three, Ken Fix is here with me from the observatory, and the planetarium. And Ken is excited. he's bouncing up and down in his chair about something which is coming up on June 4th and 5th, right?
Well, the fourth, I'll be here for to talk on the radio about it. But June 5th will be the transit of Venus, where Venus passes across the face of the sun, and it only does this in pairs. About a little over every century. The last one was 2004. This one will take place June 5th in 2012, just a few days away. And the next one won't be till December of 2117. So if anybody's hearing my voice right now, if you don't see this one, you'll probably not be around for the next one.
So tell me, what causes a transit of Venus? What is this?
It's actually as if the planets orbit on wobbly plates around the sun. And Venus laps us, they have an orbit of 243 days, and sometimes it laps us a little bit above our orbit, and sometimes it laps us a little bit below the orbit. Very seldom does it actually wind up on the same dinner plate, so to speak, as we are.
Okay.
Now, not only does this have to happen, but it also has to happen with the sun between Venus and us. It's the same phenomena that happens when we get a lunar eclipse or a solar one, where the sun or the moon passes in front of one or the other. In this case, though, it's the solar disk is not obliterated like we have when the moon goes in front of it and produces a solar eclipse, or vice versa when we're in front between the sun and the moon and we get the lunar eclipse. In this case, Venus will actually move across the face of the sun, and if kind of size-wise, if the sun were a beach ball, Venus would be about the size of a quarter.
Okay, so we're going to if we can see it through Juno's infamous cloud cover, which is entirely possible, by the way, because the weather forecast says that this weekend it's supposed to start clearing up from this rain. If that front moves through and we got a couple of sunny days, then we'd be able to see this on.
Yes, let's hope so.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah.
Otherwise, you will probably be able to find it on NASA.gov. They will have it online. And also the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii is going to be carrying it live, too. And I believe the NASA feed will be coming from the Hubble Space Telescope.
Now, you said the only two places that are going to see the entire transit are Alaska and Hawaii, the only
Correct.
Two places in the
U.S. We're going to be seeing the whole thing in its entirety. It'll start about 2 o'clock here, a little after 2, and then it'll end just before 9 o'clock. So because of the length of our day, we should be able to see the entire thing.
So it takes 7 hours for the whole
Correct,
transit
for to Venus to move completely across the face of the sun.
Okay. And during that whole period of time, if you looked at the sun through the appropriate filtering, you would see this little black dot going across the
definitely,
sun, kind of like
yes.
a black needle down there on its face.
Oh, yeah.
Now, how can you safely look at this? Because you can't stare directly at the sun.
No,
that's a
telescope
thing.
With solar filters, you'll be able to look at it. Or we have some solar filter material that people can use to view the transit with. And we will be setting up at Marine Park on June 5th with telescopes, with filters, so that people can come by and look through and see the transit in progress.
Okay. So now, if you just were completely crazy and you wanted to see this incredible phenomenon, the last one that we'll see for a century, Where would you have to go to have clear skies and good viewing?
I would suggest that it would be Hawaii, because they're more likely to have clear skies than we are in Alaska.
Okay.
Someplace in the interior might be a lot better off than we would be down here on the coast. Even Anchorage probably isn't going to fare any better than we are as far as the weather goes.
So basically, just pick your possible location, or gamble that it's gonna that you're gonna be able to see it, or watch it on the Mauna Loa.
Correct. There'll be a few other sites that'll probably have it too, but Europe's pretty much excluded from this one. Whereas last time they had the ringside seat for the entire transit. There's a very good animation that came off the Swiss Royal Observatory that I've got in my presentation tonight. That actually has a very good close-up of Venus coming out of the transit, and you can actually see the sun's light coming through the outer edges of Venus. So that's how we were able to prove that it had an atmosphere. And they were able to see that phenomena back in the early 1600s when they had a couple of transits back then. They were able to see that. So they figured out that Venus had an atmosphere way back then.
Wow.
Of course, we haven't had telescopes since about that time, so this will be the eighth time that we've been able to observe a Venus transit with the aid of telescopes.
Now, are you going to do a planetarium show on the topic here?
Well, it's incorporated into tonight's show, because tonight's show is basically a pickup show. I sort of ran out of planets and gods and goddesses to talk about, with the exception of one.
Uh-huh.
That was Eros, who was Aphrodite's son. You know him by the Roman name of Cupid, more likely than not.
Uh-huh.
So I'm covering Eros pretty much in detail tonight, along with a little bit on the annular eclipse that took place just a few weeks ago down in Northern California and Southern Oregon.
Annular eclipse.
Correct. That's when the moon moved across the face of the sun, but it didn't blot it out completely like we get a total eclipse.
This one
leaves 6% of the sun uncovered, so they get what's called the ring of fire.
So it just takes a big chunk out of the sun.
Right. It'll move across the middle, but it isn't quite far enough. It's different position in the orbit.
Right.
So it doesn't quite cover the entire face of the sun. It leaves a ring of fire around it.
Uh-huh.
So I believe that Steve Kosis and his wife were down there to view that. They're kind of eclipse nuts. So,
did I hear you caught some of that here?
Yes, we did. We saw some of it before the sun disappeared behind the clouds. We had about 30% of it blotted out by the time the sun had moved out in the eclipse as it was taking place. Now, if we had been able to see as much as we could have seen here, we would have seen about 60% of the sun's disk taken out by the moon as it passed in front.
Uh-huh.
But we were just a little bit too far north for it to be positioned right over top of it, so we basically got to see the southern section of the sun chunked out by the moon.
Can any of the other planets transit the sun where we can see them?
Well, where we can see them, the only other planet would be Mercury. Mercury transits the sun about every 13 years, but if the sun was a beach ball, Mercury would be about the size of a pea. So really not able to see that without the aid of a telescope. But the Venus transit, just looking through a filter, you'll be able to see it, definitely.
Yeah. Okay. So you're doing a kind of a pickup show, you said. You got material on this. You've also got the Eros thing. Eros, the goddess, or the god, I guess, is one thing, but you're actually talking about a near-Earth asteroid, right?
Correct. We also have an asteroid named Eros, and we sent the Near Shoemaker space probe out in 1997. And it actually went into orbit around Eros, and it soft-landed on Eros.
So it's still sitting there?
Correct.
Uh-huh.
There's a funny story associated with that. There was somebody that figured out that they could use an eminent domain claim in order to say that, okay, this facility is being used, so I can claim an eminent domain on it. And they actually wanted to say that Eros belonged to them, and they were going to charge NASA rent for the spacecraft sitting there, like parking fees. Well, that went to court and it got shot down, and they appealed it and it got shot down again. It's like, okay, if you really want to own it, get out there and hold your hand out and start picking up change or something, because you know, we're not really going to deed that to you.
Build a facility of your own, right.
Okay.
What's on Eros?
Not a whole lot.
Besides this parked spaceship, I mean.
Well, not a whole lot. It's basically rocky chunks. We were expecting to find a little bit more in the way of ice crystals or something like that. But most of the asteroid field is a bunch of rocks. It's all of them are irregularly shaped, and it's kind of like what I covered when I did my show on Pluto and trans-Neptunian objects, one of the requirements for something to be deemed a planet is that it has to have a roughly spherical shape. So it can't be all jagged and, you know, bumped out, looked like a potato or something, because a lot of them do look that way. And it also has to sweep its orbit of debris. And that's what kind of downgraded Pluto as a planet. But all of the asteroids fall into that category where they do not have a circular shape and they do not sweep their orbits of debris. And it's believed that these are the building blocks for a planet that never formed. And Jupiter's orbit and its gravity just keeps that from doing anything. So that debris is just going to stay out there. And the largest chunk out there is an asteroid called Ceres, and that's about 600 miles in diameter. But it comprises about one-third of the debris in the asteroid belt. So a lot of it is just small things, you know, maybe the size of a suitcase or a car. There's not a whole lot of them that are bigger than that. And we've only been to close by about 13 of them and only landed on one. That's Eros.
Ken, when's your show tonight?
It's at 6:30 at the Marie Drake Planetarium on Glacier Drive. And I'm hoping that everybody shows up. You'll get a lot more information on the transit, including a really neat animation of the 1882 transit that was done from some photographic plates that were only uncovered about 10 years ago by two astronomers out at the Lick Observatory in California. So I've got that, plus some animations and stuff from the last transit in 2004. And a little bit of prep on the one that's going to take place in 2012. So I'll show you what the track's going to look like for this one.
Outstanding. And you'll be back on the show, I think, on the 4th of June to talk about the exact time.
Yes, I will. I'll do everything on the transit on the 4th, and I'll do a lot more in detail, talk about it then.
So the people can put it on their calendars. They need to be down at Marine Park at what time to watch the beginning of the transit?
It'll start at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Actually, 2:04, but yeah. I was going to do the detail in the next
Tuesday.
Show.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, good enough. All right, we'll see you when that happens.
Okay, thanks again, Pat.
Good luck with the show tonight. It's about 18 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. You're listening to Juno Afternoon, and my next guest is from the library. It was the Candlestick, right, I think?
You say that like it's an ominous place.
Yeah. Jonas Lamb is here to tell us about a new new capability the library has acquired, and it's actually part of something called the OWL Project. What does OWL stand for?
Well,
I know those are the wizard's exams, but I'm wondering if it has a different meaning, right?
Well, the state of Alaska does love its acronyms, so OWL actually stands for Online with Libraries, and it's one of I'd say a dozen, just to be accurate, of broadband technology grants that were given to state library systems throughout the country, and the Alaska State Library received one of those grants. And so this technology grant is pretty lofty in its intentions, and so far we're progressing along. But its primary goal was to make broadband affordable to little rural libraries so that those community centers could actually continue to meet the demand that the public has for access to the internet and all the opportunities that that provides, but they're also giving hardware, and they've given to the Juneau Public Library video conferencing equipment as well as new public computers. So you may have noticed, if you've been in the libraries recently, in all of our meeting rooms at all three libraries now, there's these big 60-inch screens. Mm. And in addition to, you know, you can use those for in-room presentation. If you have a board meeting or, you know, a meeting in there, you can hook up your laptop and show your slides, show your photos on the screens. But if you're interested in hosting maybe a virtual conference or you have an educational event that you think could have a greater outreach to people throughout the state, you can coordinate that with me, and we can schedule that as a video conference service through the public library.
Is there a cost for using the facility?
There's no cost to use it as long as it basically complies with our normal meeting room policies. It should be an event that's free to the public and that anybody can participate in, and obviously it has to meet with our open hours. It has to be during library open hours. So with that video conferencing, there's like this whole arena of new programming that we weren't even aware of. It turns out just about every museum or educational center in the country, they have a distance education arm in which they will offer these virtual field trips to their facilities. So we visited last month, we went to the Royal Tyrrell Paleontology Museum in Alberta and brought T-Rex into the library for about 70 kids. And tomorrow night, we are going to be visiting the Space Center Houston, and their distance education team is going to be talking to us about satellites and how, yeah, maybe they're this thing that everybody's fascinated with, this outer space technology, but how does it come into play in our daily life in ways that you wouldn't even expect? We interact with satellites the minute we wake up, especially in a remote location like Juneau. So this is supposed to be more of a program for adults to kind of show them or show off this new equipment.
Well, in less than 40 minutes, we're going to be in touch with a satellite right here on KTOO because our newscasts arrive to us by satellite. Years ago, that began in Alaska at KUAC up in Fairbanks. They were one of the first stations in the United States to have satellite downlink, and they got All Things Considered in the afternoons.
Hey.
They had 45 minutes on a satellite, which was eventually turned and used for East Indian education in languages.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so it was a geosynchronous satellite orbiting down at the Earth's equator.
During one of these video conferences last week, I learned that they can download or uplink data from the Mars rovers at about 200 kilobits per second, which is faster than dial-up, which is what a lot of people in Alaska at the residential place are still utilizing.
Yes, so. I agree with you totally that we're almost we take what comes to us almost totally for granted, and we don't realize how much of that is really the responsibility of some big chunk of metal up in the in orbit above the Earth's surface.
Certainly.
Yeah. So this is just one though of programs that now become available to you. What other kinds of things can we look forward to coming over the facility?
Well, just in the last week, we featured a story time with Senator Lisa Murkowski live from Washington, D.C. It was part of the Kenai Community Library's launch for this technology. So Senator Murkowski read 10 Rowdy Ravens, a classic picture book, and we even got to hear Senator Murkowski make raven noises, which was great. She does a really good raven impersonation. She chose the book because Yvonne Zerbitz, the illustrator, is from Ketchikan, her hometown. We don't have anything planned for June. The summer reading program will be kicking into high gear, but I do imagine that it'll be the programming will kind of roll along in this video conferencing format more as the weather turns again and people want to come back into the library.
Yeah,
but if you're interested in hosting an event, you can contact me. My name's Jonas. You can call me at the library at 586-0442. Come out tomorrow night. Check out this new technology, learn something perhaps. That'll be at 6 o'clock at the downtown library. There's no charge for that, and we'll be in the large meeting room live with the Space Center Houston.
Outstanding. Thank you, Jonas.
Thanks for having me, Pat.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 29th of May, 2012. It's the birthday of the man who said the whole modern world has divided itself into conservatives and progressives. The business of progressives is to go on making mistakes. The business of the conservatives is to prevent the mistakes from being corrected. G.K. Chesterton, born London, 1874. He was 6'4" tall, nearly 300 pounds, author of the popular Father Brown detective stories. It was on this day, 1914, Edgar Lee Masters published the first poem of what would later be the Spoon River Anthology. Masters was a lawyer in Chicago, began writing short poems about the townspeople of Spoon River, a town that he based on his hometown of Lewiston, Illinois. He was afraid the people in Lewiston would take offense, so he published all of his poems individually and then as a book under the pseudonym Webster Ford, and it was an immediate commercial success. It became one of the best-selling books of poetry in American history. And it's the birthday of the writer known as Max Brand. He was born in Seattle, 1892, Frederick Faust, author of many thrillers and melodramas, romances, but it was the Western that he was famous for, best known for his novel Destry Rides Again. During the Great Depression, one of the highest-paid pulp fiction writers in America, writing a full-length novel every week, earning about $100,000 a year. He used the pseudonyms because after World War I, he was afraid that Americans wouldn't want to read books written by a man with a German last name, Faust. When World War II began, he got himself posted as a correspondent for Harper's Magazine. He was sent to the front lines and later died of a shrapnel wound in Italy among soldiers who had grown up reading his stories. Here's a poem for today by Mark Halliday, Key to the Highway. I remember riding somewhere in a fast car with my brother and his friend Jack Brooks, and we were listening to Layla and other love songs by Derek and the Dominoes. The night was dark, dark, all along the highway. Jack Brooks was a pretty funny guy, and I was delighted by the comradely interplay between him and my brother, but I tried not to show it for fear of inhibiting them. I tried to be reserved and maintain a certain dignity appropriate to my age, older by 4 years. They knew the Dominoes album well, having played the cassette many times, and they knew how much they liked it. As we rode on in the dark, I felt the music was, after all, wonderful, and I said so with as much dignity as possible. "That's right," said my brother. "You're getting smarter," said Jack. We were listening to Bell Bottom Blues at that moment. Later, we were listening to Key to the Highway, and I remember how my brother said, "Yeah, yeah," and Jack sang one of the lines in a way that made me laugh. I am upset by the fact that that night is so absolutely gone. No, upset is too strong, or is it? But that night is so obscure. Until now, I may not have thought of that ride once in 8 years, and this obscurity troubles me. Death is going to defeat us all so easily. Jack Brooks is in Florida, I believe, and I may never see him again, which is more or less all right with me. He and my brother lost touch some years ago. I wonder where we were going that night. I don't know, but it seemed as if we had the key to the highway. A poem by Mark Halliday, Key to the Highway, from Little Star, published by William Morrow and Company, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Nook, Simple Touch with Glow Light by Barnes & Noble. Designed for bedtime reading, Glow Light offers paper-like reading with the lights on or off. Available at neighborhood Barnes & Noble stores or Nook.com. Produced by Nick Vedder, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 28 minutes, 29 minutes almost after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. This is Juno Afternoon, and my guest now is going to be talking tonight at the JAC, although there has been an announcement or two made that put it in the wrong place. But the talk tonight, I believe, is at the JAC. Is that correct?
At the university.
At the university, and tomorrow night is at the JAC. Okay, tomorrow night, tonight at the university at 7 p.m. and tomorrow night at the JAC. My guest is Albert Bates. He's the author of a recent book called Biochar. And he's here to give a talk at the university on carbon-negative, non-nuclear, and prospering in degrowth. Welcome, Albert.
Oh, welcome. Thank you very much for the welcome.
Yeah.
First time in Juneau.
Yeah, well, we were talking briefly about some of the adventures that you've had, having gotten here a couple of days early and had a chance to look around a little bit. I think you have a sister who lives here, who is sitting next to you in the room. So she's going to be very quiet, she said, but we'll actually probably pull her briefly out by making enough mistakes about where you're talking that she'll feel she'll feel moved to talk. So, Albert, tell me what that title is directed toward.
Well, there's a lot of change happening around the world. I got involved with climate change back in the 1980s. I was an environmental attorney at that time, and I was fighting against a chemical company that was doing deep well injection, which is nowadays called fracking. They were fracturing the earth in order to inject toxic chemicals from a manufacturer of pesticides and herbicides, and I was trying to stop them. And their argument was, hey, don't worry about it. This area's got plenty of water. We've got plenty of surface water, lots of rivers. Don't worry about it. You're never going to need that water again. So I said, wait a minute. What about population change? What about climate change? And this being the 1980s, you know, the judge wanted to know, what do you mean? So I had to bring in experts. I had to make studies and prove what exactly I meant by climate change. And in that process, I scared myself.
As would any thinking man.
Yeah. And I wrote a book that gathered all those studies together at some point, and it was published in 1990 with a foreword by Al Gore, young congressman at the time.
Uh-huh.
And it was about the possibility of a runaway climate, that we actually might cross enough tipping points that it would alter our ability to recover. And so ever since then, I've been studying what can be done about this. And, you know, I've been to the various climate conferences like Copenhagen and Cancun and Durban, and I keep watching the impasse of national governments and international agencies like the UN and the inability basically to change the way we look at consumer society or the causes of our problems. And, you know, that just the lag time of social change and how it's not enough to really reverse the situation in the time that we need to. So from that, and being someone who's kind of solutions-oriented, I've looked around to see what can we actually do that might make some difference in the amount of time that we have. And from that, I've come up with this idea for biochar, which I'll explain, and also about the changes that are happening in the Arctic, for instance, with the melting of the sea ice. And that's changing the geopolitics of this region, and it will change lots of other things as well.
Which brings up the title of your second talk, which now I will try to be very careful about. Tonight's talk is at UAS in the main lecture hall at 7 p.m., and that's Juno 2030, Carbon Negative, Non-Nuclear, and Prospering in Degrowth. And then tomorrow evening at 5 p.m., you're doing a talk called Energy Security Without Going Broke, Destroying the Climate or Militarizing the Arctic Ocean, and that will be at the JAC downtown.
Right.
Okay, so
now
both of those, right.
Thank you very much for the PSA.
Right.
And both
Kathy
of those
didn't jump down my throat, so I know I got them right.
Folks, come. We got lots of room in the auditorium. So both of those have to do with dynamic changes. Earth systems changes, but also social changes. And for one of the major stumbling blocks that I would see when I would go to conferences like Copenhagen or Cancun is that they would continuously say things like, Well, we can't really talk about lifestyle change. That's off the table. We need to talk about technological changes or carbon trading or some other sorts of ways of tweaking the existing structure of things without greatly upsetting the way we do things. And my sense of it was that's really ignoring the low-hanging fruit, which is it's really about lifestyle change. It's really about how that we as individuals subtly make adjustments to our lifestyle in ways that are not necessarily bad or uncomfortable. They actually make it better in many ways. I wrote this book called The Post-Petroleum Survival Guide, and my whole concept for that book was, you know, it's better if you can learn to live in a world where you're no longer addicted to things like petroleum. You actually find more time to do things and enjoy the company of others and to find mutual solutions to mutual problems, and that it's a better lifestyle. It's a better way of doing things. So as I explore that, I came across other movements, other kinds of thinkers out there. One of those was this idea of degrowth, and there was just recently concluded the second international conference on degrowth, which was in Canada. And the idea is that, we've been through this long historic period over the last 200 years of the industrial age where we have been gradually expanding our economy and our footprint on the planet. And we're actually doing all that on the back of an almost unlimited supply, it seemed, of fossil fuel. That we discovered coal, and then we discovered oil and natural gas, and the energy density of those things are so much more than firewood was. It has greatly changed everything. We sent men to the moon, which we never could have done on firewood. So that was a 500 million year savings account. It took that long to store that much fossil sunlight. And now we're having to switch because we're finding we're reaching the ends of those supplies, and we need to think about how do you live on the checking account instead of the savings account. We have to go to the sunlight checking account. And so we're having to shift and rapidly think about renewable energy, and we find that, you know what, it doesn't have nearly the power density of oil or gas. Lord, what are we going to do? And we're sort of like looking over the cliff, looking over at the top of the roller coaster. And down at the bottom of the roller coaster, it's like this huge plunge and this kind of a squiggly, distant thing that we don't really know what it's going to be like. And my sense is, you know what? It is going to be a roller coaster ride, but it can be an enjoyable one. And the way you do that is you learn about degrowth, and you learn about how to make your life better in economic and civilizational descent.
To some extent, you walk the walk here. Those are grand ideas that scare most people. But as I understand it, you actually did walk down to the farm, stand at the gate, and apply for admission by praying to be let in. And you are now you've been a resident of the farm for what, about 20 years? For those who don't know what the farm is, this goes back to the days when we were all going back to hippie colonies and like that. And this is the only really surviving one. So you live in this commune down in Tennessee?
Well, it's actually 40 years. It's no longer a commune, but it was back then. And he made it sound a little bit like the Kung Fu television series with the admission to the Shenzhen Temple. But it wasn't quite that way. They're more than happy to have extra people to
no
cut.
No flute, no dragon tattoos, right?
Okay, no, I got it. No. If you could cut cane with a machete, you're more than welcome. I live there, and we were actually anticipating post-petroleum world. We were into that sort of pioneering mode. We actually thought that the Vietnam War would probably bring down civilization, and it didn't. And then there were lots of other opportunities for civilization to fall in the last 40 years, and hasn't yet. So I take being a futurist or prognosticator with a little bit of a grain of sand. I've been wrong a lot. And yet I see some mega trends out there that are difficult to dispute.
I agree on the mega trends. I'm listening to you through two sets of ears here, mine And I'm old enough that I read Stuart Brand's Whole Earth Catalog and thought about going back to the land myself. I'm also listening to you through the ears of my 19-year-old son, who believes that technology is going to solve all of our world's problems. He and I have had a lot of dinner conversations about that. And we have never resolved some of those issues, but we have a grand time talking to one another about them. But his viewpoint is that there have been doomsayers, which he has heard all of his life, the history of doomsayers, and he's actually lived through a couple of doomsayers, and in 2012 he's supposed to live through another doomsayer, you know. So the problem here is that it is very easy, I think, to take an attitude that says that there's no effect really here that I can have any, I can't have any effect on this. That what's going to happen is like you said about the conferences on the environment, that basically the individual option is more or less off the table. My sense, my ears, say that we've talked about this for a long time and that I don't see a whole lot happening other than talking and not really getting anything done. My son's sense, I think, is that it's not really going to be a disaster and we wasted all of our time talking about this whole thing anyway. Is there some place in there where your message to us kind of comes down?
Yeah, and I kind of waffle myself. I'm somebody who likes technology. I grew up in this period of our history that we're, you know, seeing men walk on the moon where my parents and grandparents could barely conceive of such a thing. So I'm a technophile. On the other hand, I can't imagine pulling up to the gas pump and asking them to fill it up with technology. There's a real world constraint. And it's not just gasoline. It's not just fossil fuels. It's everything. We're at peak everything. Because our population and the carrying capacity of the planet have reached a collision point that was predicted by the Club of Rome back in the 1970s in the Limits to Growth study. And those were primitive computers. Those were the very first computers that were allowing us for the first time to chart out what's the long-term prospects for these various different things that we use in our society, and what are the supplies of those things, what's the ultimate availability of them at an available price, and what they said looking at those early computer runs was probably around the first part of the 21st century is when we're going to hit the crunch. And lo and behold, we know we've stretched it with a little bit of technology. We've been able to learn and to do things that we hadn't thought be possible, but still we're up against hard limits. And when you talk about 6 billion, 7 billion, 8 billion, 9 billion people, and people in India wanting to have their economy get to Sweden and have the same level of consumption, people in China having the same level of consumption as North Americans, to do that becomes mind-boggling. It's just not going to happen. And no amount of technology is going to change that hard limit when we're up against it.
So what is this kind of – is then biochar a sort of an anti-technology, or what are we dealing with here?
Well
– this is kind of like your solution or a proposed solution that you're thinking
right now. I didn't like the name biochar solution when New Society proposed that for my book title.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had several other titles that I offered that I thought were better. And the reason I didn't like biochar solution was it has a certain amount of hubris.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to say, well, here's the answer. And it's actually a question in my mind, whether it's an answer. And I'm sort of like spending this book and going through dozens of chapters asking this question and asking for an answer and not really getting it either.
Well, briefly, if I understand it right, biochar consists of creating charcoal in an oxygen-deprived environment and then incorporating it back into soil because it houses and rapidly encourages the growth of the natural microbes in the soil.
That's right. It's a soil amendment. It's not really a fertilizer. It changes the structure of soil, and it's a hard carbon form. So by making this material at temperatures, in the absence of oxygen, temperatures of 600, 700 degrees, in the absence of oxygen, you begin to produce a hard crystalline almost form, which stays in the soil for thousands of years as opposed to going back into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide or methane. It doesn't rain back down and go back into the plants and be taken up. That's typically a 10, 12, 15-year cycle. So we're interrupting that short cycle, and we're putting it into a 1,000-year cycle where it stays in the soil that time. Well, if you do that on a gigaton basis, billions of tons, you can actually change the atmospheric chemistry. You can change the amount of carbon in the atmosphere and in the ocean so that more is stored in the soil and less is stored in the atmosphere and the ocean. So if we really want to bring the climate change back under control, we really need to think about ways of doing it like this. And this is one of many. I mean, planting trees is another one. It's a lot simpler. But biochar improves the food supply because by being a home for microbes and for soil microorganisms, it begins to enhance the vegetative growth, and you get much more production and much healthier and drought-resistant and pest-resistant plants, much more nutrient-dense plants, which for a food-hungry world is definitely a plus.
Mm-hmm. However, as we're reading along through the book and finding out all of the wonders that biochar could bring to us, we run into a couple of soil scientists who are afraid it'll cause the end of the world. So where does that come from?
Well, the soil
scientists...
We only
have about a minute left, so you've got to do this fairly quickly.
Sure.
Come to talk.
The soil scientists actually are saying that they're worried about it because it's too strong and it's too powerful. And that if it ran out like a giant Ponzi scheme where you got carbon credits attached to it and people got rich by making it and putting it in their gardens, then the danger is that we'll put so much in there they'll go to an ice age. That's the danger. It's not that it doesn't work. It's that it works too well.
Ah, and these are the topics that part of the topics that you'll be discussing at these two talks that you're giving tonight at 7 o'clock in the UAS auditorium in the Egan Building, and tomorrow night at the Jack at 5 p.m. The first one entitled "Carbon Negative, Non-Nuclear, and Prospering in Degrowth." The second one, "Energy Security Without Going Broke: Destroying the Climate or Militarizing the Arctic Ocean." Albert Bates, thank you so much for visiting Juneau. Kathy, thanks for bringing him here, and we'll hear more tonight at the talks.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Imagine, you've found your way to a marsh, a forest, or other natural habitat, and you've spotted an unfamiliar bird. How do you figure out what it is? Apart from the color and size of the bird, what do you look for?
There it is. You see it?
A bird's behavior offers many clues. You'll see flycatchers flycatch, darting out from a branch to catch a bug in the air, and warblers warble, although sometimes it's hard to catch them in the act. To distinguish one bird from a similar one, watch what the bird does and how it moves. Does it flick its wings? Bob up and down? Flip its tail? A field guide usually mentions these behaviors, and watching for them can help you determine which bird is which. Is the bird feeding on the ground or high in a tree? Does it walk or hop? These distinctive actions give a bird personality.
There, back to the very top of that cedar. See how it works its way down that trunk?
Watching birds is a bit like detective work. Gather enough clues, and you'll solve the mystery. You'll find all kinds of resources for learning about birds when you visit our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Minutes after 3, you're in tune with KTOO News. My guests are two people who can claim the title principal of the same school. The interim principal, Kathy Yanomura, and the incoming principal, Brenda Edwards, both from Gastineau Elementary, here to tell us about a change of leadership and a change of decor design and interior. Is that fairly adequate? Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Welcome. So the last voice you heard is the new principal, Brenda Edwards. So, Brenda, are you taking over, are you satisfied with the mess that she's made of the principalship?
I couldn't walk into a better mess. No, we'll say the exact opposite of a mess. Kathy has done an amazing job of preparing me and getting the school ready and having things organized to make a smooth transition.
Good. So how long were you interim principal?
I was just there for this 2011-2012 school year.
Okay. And where did you step in from? What were you doing before?
I had been with the Juneau School District for almost 30 years prior. About 4 years ago, I retired and moved to Bend, Oregon, about 2 years ago. And I have a son, daughter-in-law, and a grandson here, so when the opportunity to take the interim position came up, I pretty much snapped it up, and I got to spend time with my family and do a job that I really love.
Outstanding. Had you been principal before when you were here?
I was. I was at Harborview for 4 years.
Oh,
no,
okay.
5 years.
Okay. So it wasn't like you just they swept you up off the street and said, hey, what are you doing Saturday? Want to be principal?
Well, somebody asked me, oh, Kathy, so how's this interim job? Is it kind of like riding a bike? And I said, well, it's more like not working out for 4 years and then running a marathon.
Mm.
So.
Sounds fun.
Without training.
But it's been great.
Uh-huh. So tell me about Gastineau. How many students are there?
There are about 280 students.
And how does that balance with other elementary schools around
the
system?
We're one of the smaller ones.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, what's the biggest one?
Mendenhall River is probably the biggest. And I am not sure how many kids
this
they have.
This is established kind of like election districts. In other words, if you live in a certain area,
yes,
your kids go to that particular school.
And there are some boundary exemptions as well. Parents can apply for boundary exemptions. There are also, throughout the district, there are optional programs that parents can apply for that, you know, for example, the program that Brenda currently teaches in is the Tlingit Culture, Literacy, and Language program at Harborview. And there's also Montessori, and there's a charter school. And so there are all those options.
Marketing teaches us that birds of a feather tend to flock together. They live in the same neighborhoods. Does that create a kind of a cultural set for a school?
I wouldn't. You know, in my experience with the Juneau School District, it hasn't. I think that having been at Harborview for many years, and being at Gastineau for many years, the demographics are actually fair. If you look at the school itself, not the optional programs, but they parallel each other. We've got a really wide range of socioeconomic, families from various socioeconomic backgrounds. We also have a fair number of special ed students. We have lots of different ethnicities. So the big difference there is that Harborview is a much larger school.
So, Brenda, what's your background that prepares you to be principal of such a special school?
Well, I'm the second and third grade teacher in the Tlingit Culture, Language, and Literacy program at Harborview. I've always wanted to be a principal, and I've just taken on a lot of different leadership roles within the school to kind of prepare myself and get myself ready for taking the leap that I am.
Does being a principal require some different certification
yes,
licensing?
Yes, it does. And I'm finishing up this summer. I'm in the Ed Leadership Program at UAS.
At UAS. Yeah, that's a fairly recent program. I think it's like about maybe 4 or 5 years old.
Yes.
Yeah. And I don't know how many people know that program got started here, but we're training people to be school leaders at UAS has a leadership training program. Those aren't real common around the world, I don't think.
Yeah, and I think that's a big step that the community has made and that UAS has made is to prepare teachers that are local to become administrators locally.
So you snapped this program up the minute you saw it on the horizon you always wanted to be a principal.
Yeah.
How long's always?
Always? Apparently, I told my dad when I was very young that I wanted to be a principal.
Really? Huh. Were you inspired by someone? Was there a principal that you saw?
I don't remember. Yeah, I guess I just one day, my dad's a teacher, and I grew up in a teacher home, and that just appealed to me, I guess.
So what will your duties look like in relationship to Gastineau? What does the principal do?
Well, you are in charge of the school and anything that happens in the school, which is very exciting. It's going to be a change, obviously, of being in charge of just the classroom of students and, taking a bigger, wider range of view of what happens within the whole school.
Do you think, with your background, you'll emphasize native language learning more than you would if you hadn't done what you've been doing?
I think it's definitely opened my eyes to embracing the local culture and making it apparent and invisible within a whole school. And the staff already and the school already has built a really good foundation on the importance of place-based education and highlighting the not just the local cultures, but the cultures that are in our community.
Kathy, will the students have a sense that the principalship has changed?
Well, given the fact that Brenda's about a foot and a half taller than I am, yeah, I would say yes.
But, well, you know, other than height.
But, you know, she is, I believe that she is going to an absolutely perfect fit for the school. She said that when she walked in, she just felt like she was home. And I believe that. I am very pleased that she's going to be there. I think that she has, I've worked with her many years ago. I was a principal at Harborview, and I saw her quality as a teacher and her connection with students. And they're going to love her, and she is going to love that school.
So you said there are big changes coming to the interior of the school. There's a remodel project going on. What's going to happen?
They have been going on. We are going to be entering into phase two of a three-phase renovation, in which last summer, all the classrooms were renovated, and the hallway was brightened up, and there were a lot of mechanical things that were changed. This year, they're going to do the same thing to the common areas. That's the music, gym, the library, the computer lab, the office. We're going to have a commons now where the kids can have their lunch and things can be continuing on in the gym. And the front, the outside, the exterior, the front parking lot is going to change to a drop-off zone. So that parking is all going away. And right now the handicapped entrance is around the back of the school, and now because of ramps and things that are going to be put in outside, the handicapped entrance will be right there in the front. Hmm. Kids can come in just like everyone else.
These all sound like good changes.
Great stuff.
Which students in Juneau would go to Gastineau? What's the geographic boundary for the school?
All kids, all families on Douglas Island come to Gastineau School.
Oh, okay. Cool. Well, Brenda, welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Kathy, are you staying in Juneau, or are you going back home to Oregon? Or
I'll be here until the middle of June, and then I head south.
Oh, okay. Well, it's been a delight having you back in the community, and we're glad that that it all worked out so wonderfully.
Thank you.
Welcome aboard, Brenda.
Thank you.
On Juneau Afternoon, you can hear Jeff talk with Todd Hunt about rehearsals for the Juneau Volunteer Marching Band. The upcoming Hearthside Books Wildlife Authors Cruise with guest Flip Nicklin will be part of his show. And we'll also talk here about Saturday's iPad Users Group meeting. That'll be along with Writer's Almanac, music, and more tomorrow at 3 on KTOFM when Jeff Brown brings you Juneau Afternoon. Little update on the weather forecast. Tonight, rain developing in the evening, still the same. Rain Wednesday, rain Wednesday night, likely. Thursday night, cloudy. So it's much the same. It's going to get mostly cloudy on Friday, and it looks like we might clear up in the weekend, and maybe we'll be able to see the transit next Tuesday. the transit of Venus, that is. You're in tune with KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and KTOO also broadcasts on a set of translators that reach throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can tune to K276AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, you hear us on K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1, K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9, and Excursion Inlet and Icy Straits, you hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9, and in Juneau, you can get KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau. They're on digital channel 871, KRNN can be heard on digital channel 872, and KXLL can be found at 873.